Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Paper Money by Ken Follett, narrated by Patrick Tull. This book is copyrighted 1977 by Zachary Stone. The introduction is copyrighted 1987 by Holland Copyright Corporation B.V. This performance is copyrighted 1988 by Recorded Books Incorporated. Paper Money was first published in 1977, but its first American edition came out more than 10 years later, in 1987. And the author, Ken Follett, has written his own introduction for us.
This book was written in 1976, immediately before Eye of the Needle, and I think it's the best of my unsuccessful books. It was published under the pseudonym Zachary Stone, as was the Modigliani scandal, because the books are similar. They lack a central character but feature several groups of characters whose stories are linked and share a common climax. In Paper Money, the links are less fortuitous, for the book is supposed to show how crime, high finance, and journalism are corruptly interconnected. The ending is rather somber by comparison with the Modigliani scandal. In fact, it is almost a tragedy. However, it is the differences and similarities between Paper Money and Eye of the Needle that are most instructive. Readers who want the cake, not the recipe, should skip this and go straight to Chapter 1. The plot of Paper Money is the cleverest I have ever devised, and the small sales of the book convinced me that clever plots satisfy authors more than readers. The plot of Eye of the Needle is, of course, very simple. In fact, it can be written down in 3 paragraphs, as indeed I did write it when I first thought of it. Eye of the Needle has only 3 or 4 main characters, whereas Paper Money has a dozen or so. Yet, with its complex plot and large cast, Paper Money is only half the length of Eye of the Needle. As a writer, I've always had to struggle against a tendency to underwrite, and in Paper Money you see me struggling in vain. Consequently, the many characters are painted in brisk, bold brushstrokes, and the book lacks the feeling of detailed personal involvement with the private lives of the characters that readers demand of a bestseller. One of the strengths of the book is its form. The action takes place during a single day in the life of a London evening newspaper. I worked for such a newspaper in 1973 and 1974, and each chapter chronicles 1 hour of that day in 3 or 4 scenes describing both what happens at the news desk and what happens in the stories the paper is covering, or missing. Eye of the Needle has an even more rigid structure, although nobody to my knowledge has ever noticed it. There are 6 parts, each with 6 chapters, except for the last part, which has 7. The first chapter in each part dealing with the spy, the second with the spy catchers, and so on until the 6th, which always tells of the international military consequences of what has gone before. Readers do not notice such things, and why should they? But still I suspect that regularity and even symmetry contribute to what they perceive as a well-told story. The other feature Paper Money shares with Eye of the Needle is a wealth of good minor characters. Tarts, thieves, half-witted children, working-class wives, and lonely old men. In subsequent books, I've not done this, for it only diverts from the main characters and their story. Yet I often wonder whether I'm being too clever. Today I'm not as sure as I was in 1976 of the links between crime, high finance, and journalism. But I think this book is true to life in another way. It presents a detailed picture of the London that I knew in the 70s, with its policemen and crooks, bankers and call girls, reporters and politicians, its shops and slums, its roads and its river. I loved it, and I hope you will too. Paper Money, 6 a.m., Chapter 1. It was the luckiest night of Tim Fitzpeterson's life. He thought this the moment he opened his eyes and saw the girl in bed beside him, still sleeping. He didn't move for fear of waking her, but he looked at her, almost furtively in the cold light of the London dawn. She slept flat on her back with the absolute relaxation of small children. Tim was reminded of his own Adrienne when she was little. He put the unwelcome thought out of his mind. The girl beside him had red hair, fitting her small head like a cap, showing her tiny ears. All her features were small: nose, chin, cheekbones, dainty teeth. Once, in the night, he had covered her face with his broad, clumsy hands, pressing his fingers gently into the hollows of her eyes and her cheeks, opening her soft lips with his thumbs, as if his skin could feel her beauty like the heat from a fire. Her left arm lay limply outside the coverlet, which was pushed down to reveal narrow, delicate shoulders, and one shallow breast, its nipple soft in slumber. They lay apart, not quite touching, although he could feel the warmth of her thigh close to his. He looked away from her, up at the ceiling, and for a moment he let the sheer joy of remembered fornication wash over him like a physical thrill. Then he got up. He stood beside the bed and looked back at her. She was undisturbed. The candid morning light made her no less lovely, despite tousled hair and the untidy remains of what had been elaborate make-up. Daybreak was less kind to Tim Fitzpeterson, he knew. That was why he tried not to wake her. He wanted to look in a mirror before she saw him. He went, naked, padding across the dull green living room carpet to the bathroom. In the space of a few moments, he saw the place, as if for the first time, and found it hopelessly unexciting. The carpet was matched by an even duller green sofa with fading, flowered cushions. There was a plain wooden desk of the kind to be found in a million offices, an elderly black-and-white television set, a filing cabinet, and a bookshelf of legal and economic textbooks, plus several volumes of Hansard. He had once thought it so dashing to have a London pied-à-terre. The bathroom had a full-length mirror, bought not by Tim, but by his wife, in the days before she had totally retired from town life. He looked in it while he waited for the bath to fill, wondering what there was about this middle-aged body that could drive a beautiful girl of, what, 25? Into a frenzy of lust. He was healthy, but not fit. Not in the sense with which that word is used to describe men who do exercises and visit gymnasia. He was short, and his naturally broad frame was thickened by a little superfluous fat, particularly on the chest, waist, and buttocks. His physique was okay for a man of 41, but it was nothing to excite even the most physical of women. The mirror became obscured by steam, and Tim got into the bath. He rested his head and closed his eyes. It occurred to him that he had had less than 2 hours of sleep, yet he felt quite fresh. His upbringing would have him believe that pain and discomfort, if not actual illness, were the consequences of late nights, dancing, adultery, and strong drink. All those sins together ought to bring down the wrath of God. Nope. The wages of sin were sheer delight. He began to soap himself languidly. It had started at one of those appalling dinners, grapefruit cocktail, overdone steak, and bombe no surprise for 300 members of a useless organization. Tim's speech had been just another exposition of the government's strategy, emotionally weighted to appeal to the particular sympathies of the audience. Afterward, he'd agreed to go somewhere else for a drink with one of his colleagues, a brilliant young economist, and two faintly interesting people from the audience. The venue turned out to be a nightclub, which would normally have been beyond Tim's means, but someone else had paid the entrance. Once inside, he began to enjoy himself, so much so that he bought a bottle of champagne with his credit card. More people had joined their group, a film company executive Tim had vaguely heard of, a playwright he hadn't, a left-wing economist who shook hands with a wry smile and avoided shop talk, and the girls. The champagne and the floor show inflamed him slightly. In the old days, he would at this point have taken Julia home and made love to her, roughly. She liked that, just occasionally. But now she no longer came to town, and he no longer went to nightclubs. Not normally. The girls had not been introduced. Tim started to talk to the nearest, a flat-chested redhead in a long dress of some pale colour. She looked like a model and said she was an actress. He expected that he would find her boring and that she would reciprocate. That was when he got the first intimation that tonight would be special. She seemed to find him fascinating. Their close conversation gradually isolated them from the rest of the party until someone suggested another club. Tim immediately said he would go home. The redhead caught his arm and asked him not to, and Tim, who was being gallant to a beautiful woman for the first time in 20 years, instantly agreed to go along. He wondered, as he got out of the bath, what they had talked about for so long. The work of a junior minister in the Department of Energy was hardly cocktail party conversation. When it was not technical, it was highly confidential. Perhaps they discussed politics. Had he told wry anecdotes about senior politicians in the deadpan tone, which was his only way of being humorous? He couldn't remember. All he could recall was the way she had sat, with every part of her body angled devotedly toward him, head, shoulders, knees, feet, a physical attitude that was at once intimate and teasing. He wiped steam off the shaming mirror and rubbed his chin speculatively, sizing up the task. He had very dark hair, and his beard, if he were to grow it, would be thick. The rest of his face was, to say the least, ordinary. The chin was receding, the nose sharply pointed, with twin white marks either side of the bridge, where spectacles had rested for 35 years. The mouth, not small, but a little grim. The ears, too large, the forehead intellectually high. No character could be read there. It was a face trained to conceal thoughts instead of displaying emotion. He switched on the shaver and grimaced to bring all of his left cheek into view. He was not even ugly. Some girls had a thing about ugly men, he'd heard. He was in no position to verify such generalizations about women. But Tim FitzPeterson didn't even fit into that dubiously fortunate category. But perhaps it was time to think again about the categories he fitted into. The second club they'd visited had been the kind of place he would never knowingly have entered. He was no music lover, and if he had liked it, his taste would not have included the blaring, insistent row which drowned conversation in the black hole. Nevertheless, he had danced to it, the jerky exhibitionist dancing that seemed to be de rigueur here. He enjoyed it, and thought he acquitted himself well enough. There were no amused glances from the other patrons, as he feared there might be. Perhaps that's because many of them were his age. The disc jockey, a bearded young man in a T-shirt improbably printed with the words Harvard Business School, capriciously played a slow ballad sung by an American with a heavy cold. They were on the small dance floor at the time. The girl came close to him and wound her arms around him. Then he knew she meant it, and he had to decide whether he was equally serious. With her hot, lithe body clinging to him as closely as a wet towel, he made up his mind very quickly. He bent his head, she was slightly shorter than he, and murmured into her ear, "Come and have a drink at my flat." He kissed her in the taxi. There was something he hadn't done for many years. The kiss was so luscious, like a kiss in a dream, that he touched her breasts, wonderfully small and hard under the loose gown. And after that they found it difficult to restrain themselves until they reached home. The token drink was forgotten. "We must have got into bed in less than a minute," Tim thought smugly. He finished shaving and looked around for cologne. There was an old bottle in the wall cabinet. He went back to the bedroom. She was still asleep. He found his dressing gown and cigarettes and sat in the upright chair by the window. "I was pretty terrific in bed," he thought. He knew he was kidding himself. She had been the activist, the creative one. On her initiative, they'd done things which Tim could not suggest to Julia after 15 years in the same bed. "Yes, Julia." He gazed unseeing from the first floor window. Across the narrow street to the red brick Victorian school, its meagre playground painted with the fading yellow lines of a netball court. He still felt the same about Julia. If he'd loved her before, he loved her now. This girl was different. But wasn't that what fools always told themselves before embarking on an affair? "Let's not be hasty," he told himself. For her, this might be a one-night stand. He could not assume she would want to see him again. Yet he wanted to decide where his aims lay before asking her what the options were. Government had taught him to brief himself before meetings. He had a formula for the approach to complex issues. First, what have I got to lose? Julia, again. Plump, intelligent, contented, her horizons contracting inexorably with every year of motherhood. There had been a time when he lived for her. He bought the clothes she liked, he read novels because she was interested in novels, and his political successes pleased him all the more because they pleased her. But the centre of gravity of his life had shifted. Now Julia held sway only over trivia. She wanted to live in Hampshire, and it did not matter to him, so they lived there. She wanted him to wear check jackets, but Westminster chic demanded sober suits, so he wore dark, faintly patterned greys and navy blues. When he analysed his feelings, he found there was not a lot to tie him to Julia. A little sentiment, perhaps. A nostalgic picture of her, with her hair in a ponytail, doing the jive and a tapered skirt. Was that love or something? He doubted it. The girls. That was something else. Katie, Penny and Adrienne. Only Katie was old enough to understand love and marriage. They didn't see much of him, but he took the view that a little father love goes a long way and is a great deal better than no father at all. There was no room for debate there. His opinion was fixed. And there was his career. A divorce might not harm a junior minister, but it could ruin a man higher up. There had never been a divorced prime minister. Tim Peterson wanted that job. So there was a lot to lose. In fact, all he held dear. He turned his gaze from the window to the bed. The girl had rolled onto her side, facing away. She was right to have her hair short. It emphasised the slender neck and pretty shoulders. Her back tapered sharply to a small waist, then disappeared beneath a crumpled sheet. Her skin was faintly tanned. There was so much to gain. Joy was a word Tim had little use for, but it entered his thoughts now. If he'd known joy before, he couldn't remember when. Satisfaction, yes. In the writing of a sound, comprehensive report, in the winning of one of those countless small battles in committees and in the House of Commons, in a book that was correct, or a wine that was right. But the savagely chemical pleasure he had with this girl was new. There, those were the pros and cons. The formula said, now add them up and see which is greater. But this time the formula would not work. Tim had acquaintances who said it never did. Perhaps they were right. It might be a mistake to think that reasons could be counted like pound notes. He was reminded curiously of a phrase from a college philosophy lecture, "The bewitchment of our intelligence by means of language." Which is longer, an airplane or a one-act play? Which do I prefer, satisfaction or joy? His thinking was getting woolly. He made a disgusted noise, then looked quickly at the bed to see whether he had disturbed her. She slept on. Good. Out in the street, a grey Rolls-Royce pulled up at the curb 100 yards away. Nobody got out. Tim looked more closely and saw the driver open a newspaper. A chauffeur, perhaps, picking someone up at 6:30. A businessman who travelled overnight and arrived too early. Tim couldn't read the license plate, but he could see that the driver was a big man, big enough to make the interior of the car seem as cramped as a mini. He turned his mind back to his dilemma. What do we do in politics, he thought, when we face two forceful but conflicting demands? The answer came immediately. We choose a course of action which really or apparently meets both needs. The parallel was obvious. He would stay married to Julia and have an affair with this girl. It seemed a very political solution, and it pleased him. He lit another cigarette and thought about the future. It was a pleasant pastime. There would be many more nights here at the flat, the occasional weekend in a small hotel in the country, perhaps even a fortnight in the sun on some discreet little beach in North Africa or the West Indies. She would be sensational in a bikini. Other hopes paled beside these. He was tempted by the thought that his early life had been wasted, but he knew the idea to be extravagant. Not wasted, then. But it was as if he'd spent his youth working out long division sums and never discovered differential calculus. He decided to talk to her about the problem and his solution. She would say it could not be done, and he would tell her that making compromises work was his special talent. How should he begin? "Darling, I want to do this again, often." That seemed all right. What would she say? "So would I." Or, "Call me at this number." Or, "Sorry, Timmy, I'm a one-night girl." No, not that. It wasn't possible. Last night had been so good for her, too. He was special for her. She'd said so. He stood up and put out his cigarette. "I'll go over to the bed," he thought, "and I'll pull the blankets off her gently and look at her nakedness for a few moments. Then I'll lie beside her and kiss her belly and her thighs and her breasts until she wakes, and then I'll make love to her again." He looked away from her and out of the window, savouring the anticipation. The rose was still there, like a grey slug in the gutter. For some reason it bothered him. He put it out of his mind and went over to wake the girl. Chapter 2. Felix Lasky did not have much money, despite the fact that he was very rich. His wealth took the form of shares, land, buildings, and occasionally more nebulous assets, like half a film script or one-third of an invention for making instant potato chips. Newspapers were fond of saying that if all his riches were turned into cash, he would have so many millions of pounds, and Lasky was equally fond of pointing out that to turn his riches into cash would be close to impossible. He walked from Waterloo Railway Station to the city because he believed that laziness caused heart attacks in men of his age. This concern with his health was foolish, for he was as fit a 50-year-old as could be found within the square mile. Just short of 6 feet tall, with a chest like the stern of a battleship, he was about as vulnerable to cardiac arrest as a young ox. He cut a striking figure walking across Blackfriars Bridge in the brittle sunshine of the early morning. His clothes were expensive. From the blue silk shirt to the handmade shoes, by city standards, he was a dandy. This was because every man in the village where Lasky had been born wore cotton dungarees and a cloth cap. Now good clothes gave him a buzz by reminding him of what he'd left behind. The clothes were part of his image, which was that of a buccaneer. His deals usually involved risk or opportunism or both. And he took care that from the outside they looked sharper than they were. A reputation for having the magic touch was worth more than a merchant bank. It was the image that had seduced Peters. Lasky thought about Peters as he walked briskly past St. Paul's Cathedral toward their rendezvous. A small, narrow-minded man, his expertise was in the movement of cash. Not credit, but physical funds. Paper money. He worked for the Bank of England, the ultimate source of legal tender. His job was to arrange for the creation and destruction of notes and coins. He did not make policy, that was done at a higher level, perhaps in the Cabinet, but he knew how many fivers Barclays Bank needed before they did. Lasky had first met him at the cocktail party opening of an office block built by a discount house. Lasky went to such affairs for no reason other than to meet people like Peters, who might one day come in useful. 5 years later, Peters became useful. Lasky phoned him at the bank and asked him to recommend a numismatist to advise on a fictitious purchase of old coins. Peters announced that he was a collector in a small way and that he would look at them himself if Lasky wished. "Splendid," Lasky said, and rushed out to get the coins. Peters advised him to buy. Suddenly they were friends. The purchase became the foundation of a collection which was now worth double what Lasky had paid for it. That was incidental to his purpose, but he was inordinately proud of it. It turned out that Peters was an early riser, partly because he liked it, but also because money was moved around in the mornings, and so the bulk of his work needed to be done before 9 o'clock. Lasky learned that it was Peters' custom to drink coffee in a particular cafe at around 6:30 each day, and he began to join him, at first occasionally and then regularly. Lasky pretended to be an early riser himself, and joined in Peter's praise of the quiet streets and the crisp morning air. In truth, he liked to get up late, but he was prepared to make a lot of sacrifices if there was half a chance of this far-fetched scheme coming off. He turned into the cafe, breathing hard. At his age, even a fit man was entitled to blow after a long walk. The place smelled of coffee and fresh bread. The walls were hung with plastic tomatoes and watercolours of the proprietor's hometown in Italy. Behind the counter, a woman in overalls and a long-haired youth were making mountains of sandwiches ready for the hundreds of people who would snatch a bite at their desks this lunchtime. A radio was on somewhere, but it was not loud. Peters was already there, at a window seat. Lasky bought coffee and a Leberwurst sandwich and sat down opposite Peters, who was eating doughnuts. He seemed to be one of those people who never put on weight. Lasky said, "It's going to be a fine day." His voice was deep and resonant, like an actor's, with just a trace of some East European accent. Peters said, "Beautiful. And I shall be in my garden by 4:30. Lasky sipped coffee and looked at the other man. Peters had very short hair and a small moustache, and his face looked pinched. He had not yet started work, and he was already looking forward to going home. Lasky thought that tragic. He felt a momentary pang of compassion for Peters and all the other little men for whom work was a means instead of an end. "I like my work," Peters said, as if reading Lasky's mind. Lasky covered his surprise. "But you like your garden better." "In this weather, yes. Do you have a garden, Felix?"
"My housekeeper tends the window boxes. I'm not a man of hobbies."
Lasky reflected on Peter's hesitant use of his Christian name. The man was slightly awestruck, he decided. "Good. No time, I suppose. You must work very hard."
"So people tell me. It's just that I prefer to spend the hours between 6 p.m. and midnight making $50,000 and watching actors pretend to kill each other on television."
Peters laughed. "The most imaginative brain in the city turns out to have no imagination."
"I don't follow that."
"You don't read novels or go to the cinema either, do you?"
"No."
"You see, you've got a blind spot. You can't empathize with fiction. It's true of many of the most enterprising businessmen. The incapacity seems to go with heightened acumen, like a blind man's hypersensitive hearing."
Lasky frowned. Being analysed put him at a disadvantage. "Maybe," he said.
Peters seemed to sense his discomfort. "I'm fascinated by the careers of great entrepreneurs," he said.
"So am I," Lasky said. "I'm all in favour of pinching other people's brainwaves."
"What was your first coup, Felix?"
Lasky relaxed. This was more familiar territory. "I suppose it was Woolwich Chemicals," he said. "That was a small pharmaceuticals manufacturer. After the war, they set up a small chain of high street chemist shops with the object of guaranteeing their markets. The trouble was, they knew all about chemistry and nothing about retailing, and the shops ate up most of the profits made by the factory. I was working for a stockbroker at the time, and I'd made a little money playing the market. I went to my boss and offered him a half share in the profits if he would finance the deal. We bought the company and immediately sold the factory to ICI for almost as much as we paid for the shares. Then we closed the shops and sold them one by one. They were all in prime sites."
"I never understand this sort of thing," Peter said. "If the factory and the shops were worth so much, why were the shares cheap?"
"Because the enterprise was losing money. They hadn't paid a dividend for years. The management didn't have the guts to cash in their chips, so to speak. We did. Everything in business is courage."
He started to eat his sandwich. "It's fascinating," Peter said. He looked at his watch.
"I must go."
"Big day," Lasky said lightly.
"Today is one of the days, and that always means headaches." "Did you solve that problem?"
"Which?"
"Roots." Lasky lowered his voice a fraction. "Your security people wanted you to send the convoy a different way each time."
"No." Peters was embarrassed. It had been indiscreet of him to tell Lasky about that dilemma. "There is really only one sensible way to get there. However..." He stood up.
Lasky smiled and kept his voice casual. "So today's big shipment goes by the old direct route."
Peters put a finger to his lips.
"Security," he said. "Sure."
Peters picked up his raincoat. "Goodbye."
"I'll see you tomorrow, Lasky said, smiling broadly. Chapter 3. Arthur Cole climbed the steps from the station, his breath rattling unhealthily in his chest. A gust of warm air came up from the bowels of the underground, wrapped itself snugly around him, then blew away. He shivered slightly as he emerged into the street. The sunshine took him by surprise. It had hardly been dawn when he boarded the train. The air was chilled and sweet. Later it would become poisonous enough to knock out a policeman on point duty. Cole remembered the first time that had happened. The story had been an Evening Post exclusive. He walked slowly until his breathing eased. 25 years in newspapers have ruined my health, he thought. In truth, any industry would have done the same, for he was prone to worry and to drink, and his chest was weak. But it comforted him to blame his profession. Anyway, he'd given up smoking. He'd been a non-smoker. He looked at his watch. 128 minutes. Unless he counted the night, in which case it was 8 hours. He had already passed several moments of risk. Immediately after the alarm clock went off at 4:30, he usually smoked one on the WC, driving away from his house, at the moment when he got into top gear and turned on the radio, ready for the 5 o'clock news, accelerating down the first fast stretch of the A12 as his large Ford hit its stride, and waiting on a cold open-air tube station in East London for the earliest train of the day. The BBC's 5 o'clock bulletin had not cheered him. It had had all his attention as he drove, for the route was so familiar that he negotiated the bends and roundabouts automatically from memory. The lead story came from Westminster. The latest industrial relations bill had been passed by Parliament, but the majority had been narrow. Cole had caught the story the previous night on television. That meant the morning papers would certainly have it, which in turn meant that the Post could do nothing with it unless there were developments later in the day. There was a story about the retail price index. The source would be official government statistics, which would have been embargoed until midnight. Again, the mornings would have it. It was no surprise to learn that the car workers' strike was still on. It would hardly have been settled overnight. Test cricket in Australia solved the sports editor's problem, but the score was not sufficiently sensational for the front page. Cole began to worry. He entered the Evening Post building and took the elevator. The newsroom occupied the entire first floor. It was a huge, eye-shaped, open-plan office. Cole entered at the foot of the eye. To his left were the typewriters and telephones of the copy-takers, who would type out stories dictated over the phone. To the right, the filing cabinets and bookshelves of specialist writers. Political, industrial, crime, defence, and more. Cole walked up the stem of the aisle, through rows of desks belonging to ordinary common or garden reporters, to the long news desk which subdivided the room in two. Behind it was the U-shaped sub-editor's table, and beyond that, in the crosspiece of the eye, was the sports department, a semi-independent kingdom with its own editor, reporters and subs. Cole occasionally showed curious relatives around the place. He always told them it's supposed to work like a production line. Usually it's more like a bun fight. It was an exaggeration, but it always got a laugh. The room was brightly lit and empty. As deputy news editor, Cole had a section of the news desk to himself. He opened a drawer and took out a coin, then walked to the vending machine in sport and punched buttons for instant tea with milk and sugar. A teleprinter chattered to life, breaking the silence. As Cole walked back to his desk with his paper cup, the far door bumped open. A short, grey-haired figure came in wearing a bulky parka and cycle clips. Cole waved and called, "Morning, George."
"Hello, Arthur. Cold enough for you?"
George began to take off his coat. The body inside it was small and thin. Despite his age, George's title was head lad. He was chief of the office's team of messengers. He lived in Potter's Bar and cycled to work. Arthur thought that an astonishing feat. Arthur put down his tea, shrugged out of his raincoat, turned on the radio and sat down. The radio began to murmur. He sipped tea and gazed straight ahead. The newsroom was scruffy. Chairs were scattered randomly, newspapers and sheets of copy paper littered the desks, and redecoration had been postponed in last year's economy drive. But the scene was too familiar to register. Cole's mind was on the first edition.
which would be on the streets in 3 hours. Today's paper would have 16 pages. 14 of the first edition's pages already existed as semi-cylindrical metal plates on the press stand stairs. They contained advertising features, television programmes, and news written in such a way that its age would, it was hoped, be overlooked by the reader. That left the back page for the sports editor, and the front page for Arthur Cole. Parliament, a strike, and inflation. They were all yesterday stories. There wasn't much you could do with them. Any of them could be dressed up with a today intro, like Cabinet Ministers Today held an inquest on the government's narrow escape. There was one of those for every situation. Yesterday's disaster became today's news story, with Dawn Today revealed the full horror. Yesterday's murder benefited from Detectives Today searched London for the man who... Arthur's problem had given birth to scores of clichés. In a civilised society, he thought, when there was no news, there would be no newspapers. It was an old thought, and he brushed it out of his mind impatiently. Everyone accepted that the first edition was rubbish 3 days out of 6. But that gave no comfort, because it was the reason Arthur Cole had the job of producing that edition. He had been deputy news editor for 5 years. Twice during that period, the news editor's chair had fallen vacant, and both times a younger man than Cole had been promoted. Someone had decided that the number two job was the limit of his capabilities. He disagreed. The only way he could demonstrate his talent was by turning out an excellent first edition. Unfortunately, how good the edition was depended largely upon luck. Cole's strategy was to aim for a paper which was consistently slightly better than the opposition's first edition. He thought he was succeeding. Whether anyone upstairs had noticed, he had no idea, and he would not let himself worry about it. George came up behind him and dumped a pile of newspapers on his desk.
"Young Stevens reported sick again,"
he grumbled. Arthur smiled. "What is it, a hangover or a runny nose?
Remember what they used to tell us, if you can walk, you can work. Not this lot."
Arthur nodded.
"Am I right?"
George said.
"You're right." The two of them had been lads together on the post. Arthur had got his NUJ card after the war. George, who had not been called up, had remained a messenger.
George said, "We were keen. We wanted to work."
This ends side one of cassette one. Please turn the cassette over and start side two from the same point.
Arthur picked up the top newspaper from the pile. This was not the first time George had complained about his staff, nor the first time Arthur had commiserated with him. But Arthur knew what was wrong with the lads of today. 30 years ago, a smart lad could become a reporter. Nowadays, that road was closed. The new system had a double impact. Bright youngsters stayed at school instead of becoming messengers, and those who did become messengers knew they had no prospects, so they did as little work as they could get away with. But Arthur could not say this to George, because it would call attention to the fact that Arthur had done so much better than his old colleague, so he agreed that the youth of today were rotten. George seemed disposed to persist with his grouse. Arthur cut him off by saying, "Anything on the overnight wire?"
"I'll get it. Only I've got to do all the papers myself."
"I'd better see the wire copy first." Arthur turned away. He hated to pull rank. He'd never learned to do it naturally. Perhaps because he took no pleasure in it. He looked at the Morning Star. They'd led with the industry bill. It was unlikely that there would be any national news on the teletype yet. It was too early. But foreign news came in sporadically during the night, and more often than not it included one story which could be the splash and a pinch. Most nights there was a major fire, a multiple murder, a riot or a coup somewhere in the world. The Post was a London paper and did not like to lead with foreign news unless it was sensational. But it might be better than Cabinet Ministers Today held an inquest. George dumped a sheet of paper several feet long on his desk. Not cutting the sheet into individual stories was his way of showing displeasure. He probably wanted Arthur to complain so that he could point out how much work there was for him to do with the early lad off sick. Arthur fumbled in his desk for scissors and began to read. He went through a political story from Washington, a test match report, and a Middle East roundup.
He was halfway through a minor Hollywood divorce when the phone rang. He picked it up and said, "News desk."
"I've got an item for your gossip column."
It was a man's voice with a broad Cockney accent. Cole was instantly sceptical. This was not the voice of a man who would have inside information on the love lives of the aristocracy. He said, "Good. Would you like to tell me your name?"
"Never mind about that. Do you know who Tim Fitzpeterson is?"
"Of course."
"Well, he's making a fool of himself with a redhead. She must be 20 years younger than him. Do you want his phone number?"
"Please." Cole wrote it down. He was interested now. If a minister's marriage had broken up, it would make a good story, not just a gossip item. "Who's the girl?" he said.
"Calls herself an actress. Truth is, she's a brass. Just give him a ring right away and ask him about Dizzy Disney."
The line went dead. Cole frowned. This was a little odd. Most tipsters wanted money, especially for news of this kind. He shrugged. It was worth checking out. He'd give it to a reporter later on. Then he changed his mind. Innumerable stories had been lost forever by being put aside for a few minutes. Fitzpeterson might leave for the house or his Whitehall office. And the informant had said, "Give him a ring right away." Cole read the number off his notebook and dialed. 7 a.m. Chapter 4. "Have you ever watched yourself doing it in the mirror?" she'd asked. And when Tim admitted he had not, she insisted they try it. They were standing in front of the full-length glass in the bathroom when the phone rang. The noise made Tim jump, and she said, "Ouch! Careful!" He wanted to ignore it, but the intrusion of the outside world took away his desire. He left her and went into the bedroom. The phone was on a chair underneath a pile of her clothes. He found it and lifted the receiver. "Yes?" "Mr. Fitzpeterson." It was the voice of a middle-aged man with a London accent. He sounded slightly asthmatic. "Yes, who's that?"
"Evening Post, sir. I'm sorry to call you so early. I have to ask you whether it's true you're getting divorced."
Tim sat down heavily. For a moment, he was unable to breathe.
"Are you there, sir?"
"Who the devil told you that?"
"The informant mentioned a woman called Dizzy Disney. Do you know her?"
"I've never heard of her."
Tim was regaining his composure.
"Don't wake me in the morning with idle rumours."
He put the phone down. The girl came into the bedroom. "You look quite white," she said. "Who was it?"
"What's your name?" he snapped.
"Dizzy Disney." "Jesus Christ." His hands were trembling. He clenched his fists and stood up. "The papers have got hold of a whisper that I'm getting divorced.
They must hear that sort of thing about famous people all the time. They mentioned your name."
He slammed one fist into the palm of his other hand.
"How could they find out so quickly? What am I going to do?"
She turned her back on him and put her panties on. He stared out of the window. The grey rose was still there, but now it was empty. He wondered where the driver had gone. The stray thought annoyed him. He tried to assess the situation coolly. Someone had seen him leave a club with the girl and phoned the information to a reporter. The informant had built the incident up for dramatic effect, but Tim was sure that no one had seen them enter the flat together. "Listen," he said, "last night you said you weren't feeling well. I took you out of the club and got a taxi. The cab dropped me off, then took you home, all right?" "Whatever you say," she said uninterestedly. Her attitude infuriated him. "For God's sake, this involves you!" "I think my part in it's over."
"What does that mean?"
There was a knock at the door. Tim said,
"Oh, Jesus, no."
The girl zipped up her dress. "I'll go."
"Don't be such a damn fool."
He grabbed her arm.
"You mustn't be seen here, don't you understand? Stay here in the bedroom. I'll open the door. If I have to ask them in, just keep quiet until they go."
He put on his underwear shorts and struggled into his dressing gown as he crossed the living room. There was a tiny hall and a front door with a peephole. Tim swung the flap aside and put an eye to the glass. The man outside looked vaguely familiar. He had the face of a boxer, broad-shouldered and well-built. He would have been a heavyweight. He wore a grey coat with a velvet collar. Tim put his age at late 20s. He did not look like a newspaper reporter. Tim unbolted the door and opened it.
"What is it?" he said.
Without speaking, the man pushed Tim aside, stepped in, and closed the door behind him. He walked into the living room. Tim took a deep breath and tried not to panic. He followed the man. "I'm going to call the police," he said. The man sat down. He called,
Are you in there, Dizzy?
The girl came to the bedroom door.
The man said, make us a cup of tea, girl.
Do you know him?
Tim asked her incredulously. She ignored him and went into the kitchen. The man laughed. Know me? She works for me. Tim sat down.
What is this all about?
He said weakly.
All in good time.
The man looked around.
I can't say you've got a nice place here because you haven't. I expected you to have something a bit flash, know what I mean? By the way, in case you haven't recognised me, I'm Tony Cox.
He stuck out his hand. Tim ignored it. Cox said, please yourself.
Tim was remembering. The face and the name were familiar. He thought Cox was a fairly wealthy businessman, but he couldn't recall what his business was. He thought he'd seen the man's picture in a newspaper, something to do with raising money for boys' clubs in the East End.
Cox jerked his head towards the kitchen.
Did you enjoy her?
For God's sake, Tim said.
The girl came in carrying two mugs on a tray. Cox asked her, did he enjoy it?
What do you think?
She said sourly. Cox took out his wallet and counted out some bills.
Here you are,
he said to her. You've done a good job, mate, and fuck off. She took the money and put it in a handbag. She said,
you know, Tone, I think the thing I like most about you is your beautiful manners.
She went out without looking at Tim. Tim thought,
I've made the biggest mistake of my life.
As the girl left, the door slammed. Cox winked. She's a good girl.
She's the lowest form of human life, Tim spat. Now, don't be like that. She's just a good actress. She might have got into films if I hadn't have found her first. I presume you're a ponce.
Anger flashed in Cox's eyes, but he controlled it. You'll regret that little joke, he said mildly.
All you need to know about me and Dizzy is that she does what I tell her to. If I say keep your mouth shut, she does. And if I say tell the nice man from the News of the World how Mr. Fitzpeterson seduced you, she will. Do you know what I mean?
Tim said,
I suppose it was you who contacted the Evening Post. Don't worry. Without confirmation, they can't do a thing, and only three people can confirm the story. You, Dizzy, and me. You're not going to say anything. Dizzy's got no will of her own, and I can keep a secret.
Tim lit a cigarette. He was finding his confidence again. Cox was just a working-class hoodlum, despite his velvet collar and his grey Rolls Royce. Tim had the feeling he could handle the man. He said, if this is blackmail, you're onto a loser. I haven't any money.
Quite warm in here, isn't it?
Cox stood up and took his coat off.
Well, he resumed, if you haven't got money, we'll have to think of something else you can give me.
Tim frowned. He was lost again. Cox continued, in the last few months, half a dozen or so companies have put in bids for drilling rights in a new oil field called Shield, right?
Tim was astonished.
Surely this crook couldn't be connected with any of those respectable companies, he said.
Yes, but it's too late for me to influence the result. The decision's been made. It'll be announced this afternoon.
Don't jump to conclusions. I know it's too late to change it, but you can tell me who's won the license.
Tim stared. Was that all he wanted?
It was too good to be true. He said, what possible use could you have for that sort of information?
None, really. I'm going to trade it for another piece of information. I've got a deal going with this gent, so he doesn't know how I get my inside dope, and he doesn't know what I do with the stuff he tells me. That way he keeps his nose clean, you know what I mean? Now then, who gets the license?
It was so easy, Tim thought. Two words, and the nightmare would be over. A breach of confidence like this could ruin his career, but then if he did not do it, his career was finished anyway.
Cox said, if you're not sure what to do, just think of the headlines, the minister and the actress, he wouldn't make an honest woman of me, showgirl weeps.
Remember poor old Tony Lambden?
Shut up, Tim said.
It's Hamilton Holdings. Cox smiled.
My friend will be pleased, he said.
Where's the phone?
Tim jerked a thumb. Bedroom. he said wearily. Cox went into the room and Tim closed his eyes. How naive he had been. To think that a young girl like Dizzy could fall head over heels in love with someone like him. He was a patsy in some elaborate scheme which was much bigger than petty blackmail. He could hear Cox speaking.
Lasky, it's me.
Hamilton Holdings, you got that? Announcement this afternoon. Now, what about your end? There was a pause. Today? Terrific. You made my day, pal. And the roots? Another pause. What do you mean you think it's the usual? You're supposed... Okay, okay, so long. Tim knew of Lasky. He was an aging city whiz kid. But he was too emotionally exhausted to feel appropriately astonished. He could believe anything of anyone now. Cox came back in. Tim stood up. Cox said, well, a successful little morning one way and another. And don't feel too bad about it. After all, it was the best night's nookie you'll ever have. Are you going to leave now, please? Tim said, well, there is one more little matter to discuss. Give us your dressing gown.
Why?
I'll show you. Come on.
Tim was too battered to argue. He slipped the robe off his shoulders and handed it over. He stood in his shorts, waiting. Cox threw the garment to one side.
I want you to remember that word, Ponce, he said. Then he punched Tim in the stomach. Tim turned away and doubled over in agony. Cox reached out, grabbed his genitals in one huge hand and squeezed. Tim tried to scream, but he had no breath. His mouth gaped in a soundless howl as he tried desperately to suck air. Cox let go and kicked him. Tim toppled to the floor. He curled up there and his eyes flooded with tears. He had no pride, no dignity left. He said, please don't hurt me any more. Tony Cox smiled and put his coat on. Not just yet, he said. Then he went away. Chapter 5. The Honourable Derek Hamilton woke up with a pain. He lay in bed with his eyes shut while he traced the discomfort to his abdomen, examined it, and graded it bad but not incapacitating. Then he recalled last night's dinner. Asparagus mousse was harmless. He'd refused seafood pancakes. His steak had been well done. He had taken cheese in preference to apple tart, a light white wine, coffee with cream, brandy. Damn, he should stick to a port. He knew how the day would go. He would do without breakfast, and by mid-morning the hunger would be as bad as the ulcer pain, so he would eat something. By lunchtime the hunger would be back, and the ulcer would be worse. During the afternoon some trivial thing would irritate him beyond all reason. He would yell at his staff, and his stomach would bawl into a knot of pain, which made him incapable of thinking at all. He would go home and take too many painkillers. He would sleep, wake with a headache, eat dinner, take sleeping pills, and go to bed. At least he could look forward to bedtime. He rolled over, yanked open the drawer of the bedside table, found a tablet, and put it in his mouth. Then he sat up and picked up his cup of tea. He sipped, swallowed, and said, good morning, dear. Morning. Ellen Hamilton sat on the edge of the twin bed, wearing a silk robe, perching her cup on one slender knee. She'd brushed her hair already. Her nightwear was as elegant as the rest of her large wardrobe, despite the fact that only he ever saw it and he wasn't interested. That didn't matter, he surmised. It was not that she wanted men to desire her, only that she should be able to think of herself as desirable.